sun. It was now brighter than noontime. Every pebble cast a shadow. Stuff still raining down all around her. A board with a 6-inch spike protruding from it came down in front of her nose. The baby! And on the heels of that, another thought came, a reprise of her premonition. Harold did this! Harold did this! Harold! Something struck her on the head, the neck, the back. A huge thing that landed on her like a padded coffin. Oh my God! Oh my baby! Then darkness sucked her down to a nowhere place, where not even the dark man could follow. Chapter 59. Birds. She could hear birds. Fran lay in darkness, listening to the birds for a long time before she realized the darkness wasn't really dark. It was reddish, moving, peaceful. It made her think of childhood. Saturday morning, no school, no church, the day you got to sleep late. The day you could wake up a little at a time, at your leisure. You lay with your eyes shut, and you saw nothing but a red darkness that was Saturday sunshine being filtered through the delicate screen of capillaries in your eyelids. You listened to the birds in the old oaks outside, and maybe smelled sea salt, because your name was Francis Goldsmith, and you were 11 years old on a Saturday morning in Agunquit. Birds. She could hear birds. But this wasn't Agunquit. It was Boulder. She puzzled over it in the red darkness for a long time, and suddenly she remembered the explosion. Explosion? Stu! Her eyes flashed open. There was sudden terror. Stu! And Stu was sitting there beside her bed, Stu with a clean white bandage wrapped over one forearm, and a nasty-looking cut dried on one cheek, and part of his hair burned away. But it was Stu. He was alive, with her. And when she opened her eyes, the great relief came on his face, and he said, "Franny, thank God." "The baby," she said. Her throat was dry. It came out a whisper. He looked blank, and blind fear stole into her body. It was cold and numbing. "The baby," she said, forcing the words up her sandpaper throat. "Did I lose the baby?" Understanding came over his face then. He hugged her clumsily with his good arm. "No, Franny, no. You didn't lose the baby." Then she began to cry, scalding tears that flowed down her cheeks, and she hugged him fiercely, not caring that every muscle in her body seemed to cry out in pain. She hugged him. The future was later. Now the things she needed most were here in this sun-washed room. The sound of birds came through the open window. Later, she said, "Tell me, how bad is it?" His face was heavy and sorrowful and unwilling. "Fran, Nick," she whispered. She swallowed, and there was a tiny click in her throat. "I saw an arm, a severed arm. It might be better to wait." "No, I have to know. How bad was it?" "7 dead," he said in a low, husky voice. "We got off lucky, I figure. It could have been much worse." "Who, Stuart?" He held her hands clumsily. "Nick was one of them, honey. There was a pane of glass, I guess. You know, that iodized glass, and it... He stopped for a moment, looked down at his hands, then up at her again. We were able to make identification by certain scars." He turned away from her for a moment. Fran made a harsh sighing noise. When Stu was able to go on, he said, "And Sue Stern. She was still inside when it went off." "That just doesn't seem possible, does it?" Fran said. She felt stunned, numbed, bewildered. "It's true." "Who else?" "Chad Norris," he said, and Fran made that harsh sighing noise again. A single tear slipped from the corner of her eye. She brushed it away almost absently. Those were the only three from inside. It's like a miracle. Brad says there must have been 8, 9 sticks of dynamite hooked up in that closet. And Nick, he almost... When I think he might have had his hands right on that shoebox. Don't, she said. There was no way to know. That doesn't help much, he said. The other four were people who had come up from town on motorcycles. Andrea Terminello, Dean Wyckoff, Dale Pedersen, and a young girl named Patsy Stone. Stu did not tell Fran that Patsy, who had been teaching Leo how to play the flute, had been struck and nearly beheaded by a whirling chunk of Glenn Bateman's Wallensack tape recorder. Fran nodded, and it hurt her neck. When she shifted her body even a little, her entire back seemed to scream with pain. 20 had been wounded in the blast, and one of them, Teddy Wyzak of the burial committee, had no chance to recover. 2 others were in critical condition. A man named Louis Deschamps had lost an eye. Ralph Brentner had lost the 3rd and 4th fingers on his left hand.
"How badly am I hurt?" Fran asked him.
"Why, you have a whiplash and a sprained back and a broken foot," Stu said. "That's what George Richardson told me. The blast threw you all the way across the yard. You got the broken foot and the sprained back when the couch landed on you."
"Couch? Don't you remember?" "I remember something like a coffin, a padded coffin."
"That was the couch. I yanked it off you myself. I was raving and pretty hysterical, I guess. Larry came over to help me and I punched him in the mouth. That's how bad off I was."
She touched his cheek, and he put his hand over hers.
"I thought you had to be dead. I remember thinking that I didn't know what I'd do if you were. Go crazy, I guess."
"I love you," she said.
He hugged her, gently, because of her back, and they remained that way for some time.
"Harold," she said at last.
"And Nadine Cross," he agreed. "They hurt us. They hurt us bad. But they didn't do anywhere near the damage they wanted to. And if we catch him before they get too far west..." He held his hands, which were scratched and scabbed over, out in front of him, and closed them with a sudden snap that made the joints pop. The hamstrings stood out on the insides of his wrists. A sudden cold grin surfaced on his face that made Fran want to shudder. It was too familiar.
"Don't smile like that," she said, "ever."
The smile faded. "People have been scouring the hills for them since daybreak," he went on, no longer smiling. "I don't think they'll find them. I told them not to go further than 50 miles west of Boulder, no matter what. And I imagine Harold was smart enough to get them further than that. But we know how they did it. They had the explosive hooked up to a walkie-talkie." Fran gasped, and Stu looked at her with concern. "What's wrong, babe? Is it your back?"
"No."
She was suddenly understanding what Stu had meant about Nick having his hands on the shoebox when the explosive was detonated. Suddenly understanding everything. Speaking slowly, she told him about the snips of wire and the walkie-talkie box under the air hockey table.
"If we'd searched the whole house instead of just taking his damn book, we might have found the bomb," she said, and her voice began to choke and break. "Nick and Sue would still be alive and—"
He held her. "Is that why Larry seems so down this morning? I thought it was because I punched him."
"Franny, how could you know, huh? How could you possibly know?"
"We should have known. We should have known."
She buried her face against the good darkness of his shoulder. More tears, hot and scalding. He held her, bent over awkwardly because the electrically powered hospital bed would not crank up.
"I don't want you blaming yourself, Franny. It's happened. I'm telling you, there's no way anybody, except maybe a bomb squad detective, could make something out of a few snips of wire and an empty box. If they'd left a couple of sticks of dynamite or a blasting cap around, that would have been a different proposition. But they didn't. I don't blame you, and nobody else in the zone is going to blame you either."
As he spoke, 2 things were combining, slowly and belatedly, in her mind. Those were the only 3 from inside. It's like a miracle. Mother Abigail, she's come back. Oh, she's in terrible shape. We need a miracle.
With a little hiss of pain, she drew herself up a little so she could look into Stu's face.
"Mother Abigail," she said, "we all would have been inside when it went off if they hadn't come up to tell us."
"It's like a miracle," Stu repeated. "She saved our lives. Even if she is..." He fell silent.
"Stu?"
"She saved our lives by coming back when she did, Franny. She saved our lives."
"Is she dead?"
Fran asked. She grabbed his hand, clutched it.
"Stu, is she dead too?"
"She came back into town around 7:45. Larry Underwood's boy was leading her by the hand. He'd lost all his words, you know he does that when he gets excited, but he took her to Lucy. Then she just collapsed." Stu shook his head. "My God, how she ever walked as far as she did, and what she can have been eating or doing. I'll tell you something, Fran, there's more in the world and out of it than I ever dreamed of back in Arnett. I think that woman is from God. Or was." She closed her eyes.
"She died, didn't she, in the night? She came back to die."
"She's not dead yet. She ought to be, and George Richardson says she'll have to go soon. But she's not dead yet." He looked at her simply and nakedly. "And I'm afraid. She saved our lives by coming back, but I'm afraid of her. And I'm afraid of why she came back."
"What do you mean, Stu? Mother Abigail would never harm..."
"Mother Abigail does what her God tells her to," he said harshly. "That's the same God murdered his own boy, or so I heard."
"Stu!"
The fire died out of his eyes. "I don't know why she's back or if she has anything left to tell us at all. I just don't know. Maybe she'll die without regaining consciousness. George says that's the most likely. But I do know that the explosion, and Nick dying and her coming back, it's taken the blinkers off this town. They're talking about him. They know Harold was the one who set off the blast, but they think he made Harold do it. Hell, I think so, too. There's plenty who are saying Flagg's responsible for Mother Abigail coming back the way she is, too. Me, I don't know. I don't know nothing, seems like. But I feel scared. Like it's going to end bad. I didn't feel that way before, but I do now."
"But there's us," she said, almost pleading with him. "There's us and the baby, isn't there? Isn't there?"
He didn't answer for a long time. She didn't think he was going to answer. And then he said, "Yeah, but for how long?" Near dusk on that day, the 3rd of September, people began to drift slowly, almost aimlessly, down Table Mesa Drive toward Larry and Lucy's house, singly, by couples, in threes. They sat on the front steps of houses that bore Harold's X sign on their doors. They sat on curbs and lawns that were dry and brown at this long summer's ending. They talked a little in low tones. They smoked their cigarettes and their pipes. Brad Kitchener was there, one arm wrapped in a bulky white bandage and supported in a sling. Candy Jones was there, and Rich Moffat showed up with two bottles of black velvet in a newsboy's pouch. Norman Kellogg sat with Tommy Gerringer, his shirt sleeves rolled up to show sunburned, freckled biceps. The Gerringer boy's sleeves were rolled up in imitation. Harry Dunbarton and Sandy Duchenne sat on a blanket together, holding hands. Dick Volman, Chip Hobart, and 16-year-old Tony Donahue sat in a breezeway half a block up from Larry's tract house, passing a bottle of Canadian Club back and forth, chasing it with warm 7-Up. Patty Kroger sat with Shirley Hammett. There was a picnic hamper between them. The hamper was well filled, but they only nibbled. By 8 o'clock, the street was lined with people, all of them watching the house. Larry's cycle was parked out front, and George Richardson's big Kawasaki 650 was parked beside it. Larry watched them from the bedroom window. Behind him, in his and Lucy's bed, Mother Abigail lay unconscious. The dry, sickly smell coming from her filled his nose and made him want to puke. He hated to puke, but he wouldn't move. This was his penance for escaping while Nick and Susan died. He heard low voices behind him, the death watch around her bed. George would be leaving for the hospital shortly to check on his other patients. There were only 16 now. 3 had been released. And Teddy Wyzak had died. Larry himself had been totally unhurt. Same old Larry. Keeps his head while others all around him are losing theirs. The blast had thrown him across the driveway and into a flower bed, but he had not sustained a single scratch. Jagged shrapnel had rained it down all around him, but nothing had touched him. Nick had died, Susan had died, and he had been unhurt. Yep, same old Larry Underwood. Death watch in here, death watch out there, all the way up the block. 600 of them, easy. Harold, you ought to come on back with a dozen hand grenades and finish the job. Harold. He had followed Harold all the way across the country, had followed a trail of payday candy wrappers and clever improvisations. Larry had almost lost his fingers getting gas back in Wells. Harold had simply found the plug vent and used a siphon. Harold was the one who had suggested the memberships in the various committees slide upward with population. Harold, who had suggested that the ad hoc committee be accepted in toto. Clever Harold. Harold and his ledger. Harold and his grin. It was all well and good for Stu to say no one could have figured out what Harold and Nadine were up to from a few scraps of wire on an air hockey table. With Larry, that line of reasoning just didn't hold up. He had seen Harold's brilliant improvisations before. One of them had been written on the roof of a barn in letters almost 20 feet high, for Christ's sweet sake. He should have guessed. Inspector Underwood was great at ferreting out candy wrappers, but not so great when it came to dynamite. In point of fact, Inspector Underwood was a bloody asshole.
Larry, if you knew.
Nadine's voice.
If you want, I'll get down on my knees and beg.
That had been another chance to avert the murder and destruction, one he could never bring himself to tell anybody about. Had it really been in the works even then? Probably, if not the specifics of the dynamite bomb wired to the walkie-talkie, then at least some general plan. Flag's plan. Yes, in the background there was always Flag, the dark puppet master, pulling the strings on Harold, Nadine, on Charlie Impening. God knew how many others. The people in the zone would happily lynch Harold on sight, but it was Flag's doing, and Nadine's. And who had sent her to Harold, if not Flag? But before she had gone to Harold, she had come to Larry, and he had sent her away. How could he have said yes? There was his responsibility to Lucy. That had been all important, not just because of her, but because of himself. He sensed it would take only one or two more fades to destroy him as a man for good. So he had sent her away, and he supposed Flag was well pleased with the previous night's work, if Flag was really his name. Oh, Stu was still alive, and he spoke for the committee. That was the mouth that Nick could never use. Glenn was alive, and Larry supposed he was the point man of the committee's mind. But Nick had been the heart of the committee, and Sue, along with Franny, had served as its moral conscience. Yes, he thought bitterly, all in all a good evening's work for that bastard. He ought to reward Harold and Nadine well when they got over there. He turned from the window, feeling a dull throb behind his forehead. Richardson was taking Mother Abigail's pulse. Lori was fiddling with the IV bottles hung on their T-shaped rack. Dick Ellis was standing by. Lucy sat by the door, looking at Larry. "How is she?" Larry asked George.
"The same," Richardson said.
"Will she live through the night?"
"I can't say, Larry."
The woman on the bed was a skeleton covered with thinly stretched ash-gray skin. She seemed without sex. Most of her hair was gone, her breasts were gone, her mouth hung unhinged, and her breath rasped through it harshly. To Larry, she looked like pictures he had seen of the Yucatan mummies. Not decayed, but shriveled, cured, dry, ageless. Yes, that's what she was now, not a mother, but a mummy. There was only that harsh sigh of her respiration, like a light breeze through hay stubble. How could she still be alive, Larry wondered. And what god would put her through it? To what purpose? It had to be a joke, a big cosmic horse laugh. George said he had heard of similar cases, but never of one so extreme, and he himself had never expected to see one. She was somehow eating herself. Her body had kept running long after it should have succumbed to malnutrition. She was breaking down parts of herself for nourishment that had never been meant to be broken down. Lucy, who had lifted her onto the bed, had told him in a low, marveling voice that she seemed to weigh no more than a child's box kite, a thing only waiting for a puff of wind to blow it away forever. And now Lucy spoke from her corner by the door, startling all of them.
"She's got something to say,"
Laurie said uncertainly.
"She's in deep coma, Lucy. The chances that she can ever regain consciousness. She came back to tell us something, and God won't let her go until she does."
"But what could it be, Lucy?" Dick asked her.
"I don't know," Lucy said, "but I'm afraid to hear it. I know that. The dying ain't over. It's just got started. That's what I fear."
There was a long silence that George Richardson finally broke. "I've got to get up to the hospital. Laurie, Dick, I'm going to need both of you."
"You aren't going to leave us alone with this mummy, are you?" Larry almost asked, and pinched his lips shut to keep it in.
The three of them went to the door, and Lucy got them their coats. The temperature was barely 60 this night, and riding a cycle in shirt sleeves was uncomfortable.
"Is there anything we can do for her?" Larry asked George quietly.
"Lucy knows about the IV drip," George said. "There's nothing else. You see..." He trailed off. Of course they all saw. It was on the bed, wasn't it?
"Good night, Larry, Lucy," Dick said.
They went out. Larry drifted back to the window. Outside, everyone had come to their feet, watching. Was she alive? Dead? Dying? Perhaps healed by the power of God? Had she said anything? Lucy slipped an arm around his waist, making him jump a little.
"I love you," she said.
He groped for her, held her. He put his head down and began to shudder helplessly.
"I love you," she said calmly. "It's all right. Let it come. Let it come out, Larry."
He cried. The tears were as hot and hard as bullets.
"Lucy,
shh."
Her hands on the back of his neck, her soothing hands.
"Oh, Lucy, my God, what is all this?"
he cried out against her neck. And she held him as tight as she could, not knowing yet. And Mother Abigail breathed harshly behind them, holding on in the depths of her coma. George drove up the street at walking speed, passing the same message over and over again. "Yes, still alive. Prognosis is poor. No, she hasn't said anything and isn't likely to. You might as well go home. If anything happens, you'll hear." When they reached the corner, they accelerated, turning toward the hospital. The exhaust of their bikes crackled and echoed back, hitting buildings and bouncing off them, finally fading away to nothing. People did not go home. They remained standing for a while, renewing their conversations, examining each word George had said. Prognosis? Now what might that mean? Coma? Brain death? If her brain was dead, that was it. Might as well expect a can of peas to talk as a person with a dead brain. Well, maybe that would be it if this was a natural situation, but things were hardly natural anymore, were they? They sat down again. Darkness came. The glow of Coleman lamps came on in the house where the old woman lay. They would go home later and lie sleepless. Talk turned hesitantly to the dark man. If Mother Abigail died, didn't that mean he was stronger?
"What do you mean, not necessarily?"
"Well, I hold he's Satan, pure and simple. The Antichrist, that's what I think. We're living out the book of Revelation right in our own time. How can you doubt it? And the seven vials were opened. Sure sounds like the superflu to me." "Ah, balls, people said Hitler was the Antichrist. If those dreams come back, I'll kill myself. In mine, I was in a subway station, and he was the ticket taker, only I couldn't see his face. I was scared. I ran into the subway tunnel. Then I could hear him running after me and gaining. In mine, I was going down cellar to get a jar of pickled watermelon slices, and I saw someone standing by the furnace, just a shape, and I knew it was him." Crickets began to chirrup. Stars spread across the sky.
The chill in the air was duly commented on. Drinks were drunk. Pipes and cigarettes glowed in the dark.
I heard the power people went right ahead turning things off.
Good for them. If they don't get the lights and heat back on pretty quick, we're going to be in a peck of trouble.
Low murmur of voices, now faceless in the gloom.
I guess we're safe for this winter, sure enough. No way he can get over the passes, too full of cars and snow. But in the spring?
Suppose he's got a few A-bombs.
Fuck the A-bomb. What if he's got a few of those dirty neutron bombs? Or the other six of Sally's seven vials?
Or planes?
What's to do?
I don't know.
Damn if I know.
Ain't got a friggin' clue.
Dig a hole and then jump in and pull it over you.
And around 10 o'clock, Stu Redman, Glenn Bateman, and Ralph Brentner came among them, talking quietly and giving out flyers, telling them to pass the word on to those not here tonight. Glenn was limping slightly because a flying stove dial had clipped a piece of meat out of his right calf. The mimeographed posters said, "Free Zone Meeting, Munsinger Auditorium, September 4th, 8 p.m. That seemed to be the signal to leave. People drifted away silently into the dark. Most of them took the flyers, but quite a few were crumpled into balls and thrown away. All of them went home to get what sleep they could. Perchance to dream. The auditorium was crammed but extremely quiet when Stu convened the meeting the following night. Sitting behind him were Larry, Ralph, and Glenn. Fran had tried to get up, but her back was still much too painful. Unmindful of the grisly irony, Ralph had patched her through to the meeting by walkie-talkie.
"There's a few things that need talking about," Stu said with quiet and studied understatement. His voice, although only slightly amplified, carried well in the silent hall. "I guess there's nobody here who doesn't know about the explosion that killed Nick and Sue and the others, and nobody who doesn't know that Mother Abigail has come back. We need to talk about those things, but we wanted you to have some good news first. Want you to listen to Brad Kitchener for that. Brad?"
Brad walked toward the podium, not nearly as nervous as he had been the night before last, and was greeted by listless applause. When he got there, he turned to face them, gripping the lectern in both hands, and said simply, "We're going to switch on tomorrow." This time, the applause was much louder. Brad held up his hands, but the applause rode over him in a wave. It held for 30 seconds or more. Later, Stu told Franny that if it hadn't been for the events of the last 2 days, Brad probably would have been dragged down from the podium and carried around the auditorium on the shoulders of the crowd, like a halfback who has scored the winning touchdown of the championship game in the last 30 seconds. It had gotten so close to the end of the summer that, in a way, that was just what he was. But at last the applause subsided. "We're going to switch on at noon, and I'd like to have every one of you at home and ready."
"Ready for what?"
"Four things. Listen up now, this is important. First, turn off every light and electrical appliance in your own house that you're not using. Second, do the same for the unoccupied houses around yours. Third, if you smell gas, track down the smell and shut off whatever is on. Fourth, if you hear a fire siren, go to the source of the sound, but go safely and sanely. Let's not have any necks broken in motorcycle accidents. Now, are there any questions?" There were several, all of them reconfirming Brad's original points. He answered each one patiently, the only sign of nervousness the way he bent his little black notebook ceaselessly back and forth in his hands. When the questions had slowed to a trickle, Brad said, "I want to thank the folks who busted their humps getting us going again, and I want to remind the Power Committee that it isn't disbanded. There are going to be lines down, power outages, oil supplies to track down in Denver and haul up here. I hope you'll all stick with it. Mr. Glenn Bateman says we may have 10,000 people here by the time the snow flies, and a lot more next spring. There's power stations in Longmont and Denver that are going to have to come online before next year's done with."
"Not if that hard case gets his way," someone shouted out hoarsely in the back of the hall.
There was a moment of dead silence. Brad stood with his hands clutching the lectern in a death grip, his face pasty white. "He's not going to be able to finish," Stu thought. And then Brad did go on, his voice amazingly even.
My business is power, whoever said that. But I think we'll be here long after that other guy's dead and gone. If I didn't think that, I'd be wrapping motors over on his side. Who gives a shit for him? Brad stepped away from the podium and someone else bellowed, "You're goddamn right!" This time the applause was heavy and hard, nearly savage. But there was a note to it Stu didn't like. He had to pound with his gavel a long time to get the meeting back under control. The next thing on the agenda... "Fuck your agenda," a young woman yelled stridently. "Let's talk about the Dark Man. Let's talk about Flag. It's long overdue, I'd say." Roars of approval, shouts of out of order, disapproving babble at the young woman's choice of words, rumble of side chatter. Stu whacked at the block on the podium so hard that the mallet head flew off his gavel. "This is a meeting here," he shouted. "You're going to get a chance to talk about whatever you want to talk about, but while I'm chairing this meeting, I want to have some order." He bellowed the last word so loudly that feedback cut through the auditorium like a boomerang, and they quieted at last. "Now," Stu said, his voice purposely low and calm, "the next thing is to report to you on what happened up at Ralph's on the night of September 2nd. And I guess that falls to me since I'm our elected law enforcement officer." He had quiet again, but like the applause that had greeted Brad's closing remarks, this wasn't a quiet Stu liked. They were leaning forward, intent, their expressions greedy. It made him feel disquieted and bewildered, as if the free zone had changed radically over the last 48 hours, and he didn't know what it was anymore. It made him feel the way he'd felt when he had been trying to find his way out of the Stovington Plague Center, a fly caught and struggling in an invisible spider's web. There were so many faces he didn't recognize out there, so many strangers. But there was no time to think about it now. He described the events leading up to the explosion briefly, omitting Fran's last-minute premonition. With the mood they were in, they didn't need that. "Yesterday morning, Brad and Ralph and I went up and poked through the ruins for 3 hours or more. We found what seemed to be a dynamite bomb wired up to a walkie-talkie. It appears that this bomb was planted in the living room closet. Bill Scanlon and Ted Frampton found another walkie-talkie up in Sunrise Amphitheater, and we assume the bomb was set off from there. It—"
"Assume my ass," Ted Frampton shouted from the third row. "It was that bastard Lauder and his little whore."
An uneasy murmur ran through the room.
"These are the good guys? They don't give a shit about Nick and Sue and Chad and the rest. They're like a lynch mob, and all they care about is catching Harold and Nadine and hanging them. Like a charm against the Dark Man."
He happened to catch Glenn's eye. Glenn offered him a very small, very cynical shrug.
"If one more person yells out from the floor without being recognized, I'm going to declare this meeting closed and you can talk to each other," Stu said. "This is no bull session. If we don't keep to the rules, where are we?"
Ted Frampton was staring up at him angrily, and Stu stared back. After a few moments, Ted dropped his eyes.
"We suspect Harold Lauder and Nadine Cross. We have some good reasons, some pretty convincing circumstantial evidence. But there's no real hard evidence against them yet, and I hope you'll keep that in mind."
A sullen eddy of conversation rippled and disappeared.
"I only said that to say this," Stu continued. "If they happen to wander back into the zone, I want them brought to me. I'll lock them up, and Al Bundell will see to it that they're tried. And a trial means they get to tell their side, if they got one. We're supposed to be the good guys here. I guess we know where the bad guys are. And being the good guys means we have to be civilized about this."
He looked out at them hopefully and saw only puzzled resentment. Stuart Redman had seen two of his best friends blown to hell, those eyes said, and here he was taking up for the ones who did it.
"For what it's worth to you, I think they're the ones," he said. "But it's got to be done right. And I'm here to tell you that it will be."
Eyes boring into him, over 1,000 pairs, and he could feel the thought behind each one. "What's this shit you're talking anyway? They're gone, gone west. You act like they were on a 2-day bird-watching trip." He poured a glass of water and drank some, hoping to get rid of the dryness in his throat. The taste of it, boiled and flat, made him grimace.
Anyway, that's where we stand on that, he said lamely. What's next, I guess, is filling the committee back up to strength. We're not going to do that tonight, but you ought to be thinking about who you want. A hand shot up on the floor and Stu pointed. Go ahead, just identify yourself so everybody will know who you are. I'm Sheldon Jones, a big man in a wool plaid shirt said. Why don't we just go ahead and get two new ones tonight? I nominate Ted Frampton over there. Hey, I second that, Bill Scanlon yelled. Beautiful! Ted Frampton clasped his hands and shook them over his head to scattered applause, and Stu felt that despairing, disoriented feeling sweep over him again. They were supposed to replace Nick Andros with Ted Frampton? It was like one of those sick jokes. Ted had tried the Power Committee and found it too much like work. He had drifted over to the Burial Committee, and that had seemed to suit him better, although Chad had mentioned to Stu that Ted was one of those fellows who seemed able to stretch a coffee break into a lunch hour, and a lunch hour into a half-day vacation. He had been quick to join yesterday's hunt for Harold and Nadine, probably because it offered a change. He and Bill Scanlon had stumbled on the walkie-talkie up at sunrise through sheer luck, and to give Ted his due, he had admitted that. But since the find, he had acquired a swagger that Stu didn't like at all. Now Stu caught Glenn's eyes again and could almost read Glenn's thought in the cynical look there, the slight tuck in the corner of Glenn's mouth. Maybe we could use Harold to stack this one, too. A word that Nixon had used a lot suddenly floated into Stu's mind, and as he grasped it, he suddenly understood the source of his despair and feeling of disorientation. The word was mandate. Their mandate had disappeared. It had gone up two nights ago in a flash and a roar. He said, "You may know who you want, Sheldon, but I imagine some of the other folks would like to have time to think it over. Let's call the question. Those of you who want to elect two new reps tonight, say aye." Quite a few ayes were shouted out. "Those of you who'd like a week or so to think it over, say nay." The nays were louder, but not by a whole lot. A great many people had abstained altogether, as if the topic had no interest for them. "Okay," Stu said. "We'll plan to meet here in Munsinger Auditorium a week from today, September 11th, to nominate and vote on candidates for the two empty slots on the committee." "Pretty crappy epitaph, Nick. I'm sorry." "Dr. Richardson is here to talk to you about Mother Abigail and about those folks that were injured in the explosion. Doc?" Richardson got a solid blast of applause as he stepped forward, polishing his eyeglasses. He told them that there were 9 dead as a result of the explosion, 3 people still in critical condition, 2 in serious condition, 8 in satisfactory condition. "Considering the force of the blast, I think that fortune was with us. Now, concerning Mother Abigail." They leaned forward. "I think a very short statement and a brief bit of elaboration should suffice. The statement is this: I can do nothing for her." A mutter ran through the crowd and stilled. Stu saw unhappiness, but no real surprise. "I am told by members of the Zone who were here before she left that the lady claimed 108 years. I can't vouch for that, but I can say she is the oldest human being I myself have ever seen and treated. I'm told she has been gone for 2 weeks, and my estimation, no, my guess, is that her diet during that period contained no prepared foods at all. She seems to have lived on roots, herbs, grass, and other things of a similar nature." He paused. "She has had one small bowel movement since she returned. It contained a number of small sticks and twigs." "My God," someone muttered, and it was impossible to tell if the voice belonged to a man or a woman. "One arm is covered with poison ivy. Her legs are covered with ulcerations, which should be running if her condition were not so..." "Hey, can't you stop it?" Jack Jackson hollered, standing up. His face was white, furious, miserable. "Don't you have any damn decency?" "Decency is not my concern, Jack. I'm only reporting her condition as it is. She's comatose, malnourished, and most of all, she's very, very old. I think she's going to die. If she was anyone else, I would state that as a certainty. But like all of you, I dreamed of her. Her and one other." The low mutter again, like a passing breeze, and Stu felt the hackles on the nape of his neck first stir and then come to attention.
"To me, dreams of such opposing configurations seem mystical," George said. "The fact that we all shared them seems to indicate a telepathic ability at the very least. But I pass on parapsychology and theology just as I pass on decency, and for the same reason. Neither of them is my field. If the woman is from God, he may choose to heal her. I cannot. I will tell you that the fact that she is still alive at all seems a miracle of sorts to me. That is my statement. Are there any questions?"
There weren't. They looked at him, stunned, some of them openly weeping.
"Thank you," George said, and returned to his seat in a dead sea of silence.
"All right," Stu whispered to Glenn. "You're on."
Glenn approached the podium without introduction and gripped it familiarly.
"We've discussed everything but the Dark Man," he said.
That mutter again. Several men and women instinctively made the sign of the cross. An elderly woman on the left-hand aisle placed her hands rapidly across her eyes, mouth, and ears in an eerie imitation of Nick Andros before refolding them over the bulky black purse in her lap.
"We've discussed him to some degree in closed committee meetings," Glenn went on, his tone calm and conversational, "and the question came up in private as to whether or not we should bring the question up in public. The point was made that no one in the zone really seemed to want to talk about it. Not after the funhouse dreams we all had on the way here. That perhaps a period of recuperation was needed. Now, I think, is the time to bring the subject up. To drag him out into the light, as it were. In police work, they have a handy gadget called the Identikit, which a police artist uses to create the face of a criminal from various witnesses' recollections of him. In our case, we have no face, but we do have a series of recollections that form at least an outline of our antagonist. I've talked to quite a few people about this, and I would like to present you with my own Identikit sketch. This man's name seems to be Randall Flagg, although some people have associated the names Richard Fry, Robert Fremont, and Richard Fremantle with him. The initials RF may have some significance, but if so, none of us on the Free Zone Committee know what it is. His presence, at least in dreams, produces feelings of dread, disquiet, terror, horror. In case after case, the physical feeling associated with him is one of coldness. Heads were nodding, and that excited hum of conversation broke out again. Stu thought they sounded like boys who had just discovered sex, were comparing notes, and were excited to find that all reports put the receptacle in approximately the same place. He covered a slight grin with his hand and reminded himself to save that one for Fran later on.
"This flag is in the West," Glenn continued. "Equal numbers of people have seen him in Las Vegas, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland. Some people, Mother Abigail was among them, claim that Flagg is crucifying people who step out of line. All of them seem to believe that there is a confrontation shaping up between this man and ourselves, and that Flagg will stick at nothing to bring us down. And sticking at nothing includes quite a lot. Armored force, nuclear weapons, perhaps plague."
"I'd like to catch hold of that dirty bastard," Rich Moffat called shrilly. "I'd give him a dose of the ever fucking plague."
There was a tension-relieving burst of laughter, and Rich got a hand. Glenn grinned easily. He had given Rich his cue and his line half an hour before the meeting, and Rich had delivered admirably. Old Baldy had been right as rain about one thing, Stu was discovering. A background in sociology often came in handy at large meetings.
"All right, I've outlined what I know about him," he went on. "My last contribution before throwing the meeting open to discussion is this. I think Stu is right in telling you that we have to deal with Harold and Nadine in a civilized way if they're caught, but like him, I think that is unlikely. Also like him, I believe they did what they did on this man Flagg's orders."
His words rang out strongly in the hall.
"This man has got to be dealt with. George Richardson told you mysticism isn't his field of study. It isn't mine either. But I tell you this, I think that dying old woman somehow represents the forces of good as much as Flagg represents the forces of evil.
I think that whatever power controls her used her to bring us together. I don't think that power intends to forsake us now. Maybe we need to talk it over and let some air into those nightmares. Maybe we need to begin deciding what we're going to do about him. But he can't just walk into this zone next spring and take over. Not a few people are standing watch. Now I'll turn the meeting back to Stu, who'll chair the discussion. His last sentence was lost in a crash of applause, and Glenn went back to his seat feeling pleased. He had stirred them with a big stick, or was the phrase, played them like a violin. It didn't really matter. They were more mad than scared. They were ready for a challenge, although they might not be so eager next April after they'd had a long winter to cool off in. And most of all, they were ready to talk. And talk they did for the next 3 hours. A few people left as midnight came and went, but not many. As Larry had suspected, no good hard advice came out of it. There were wild suggestions. A bomber and/or a nuclear stockpile of their own, a summit meeting, a trained hit squad. There were few practical ideas. For the final hour, person after person stood up and recited his or her dream to the seemingly endless fascination of the others. Stu was once again reminded of the endless bull sessions about sex he had participated in, mostly as a listener, during his teenage years. Glenn was both amazed and heartened by their growing willingness to talk and by the charged atmosphere of excitement that had taken over the dull blankness with which they had begun the meeting. A large catharsis, long overdue, was going on, and he was also reminded of sex talk, but in a different way. They talk like people, he thought, who have kept the huddled-up secrets of their guilts and inadequacies to themselves for a long time, only to discover that these things, when verbalized, were only life-sized after all. When the inner terror sowed in sleep was finally harvested in this marathon public discussion, the terror became more manageable, perhaps even conquerable. The meeting broke up at 1:30 in the morning, and Glenn left it with Stu, feeling good for the first time since Nick's death. He left feeling they had gone the first hard steps out of themselves and toward whatever battleground there would be. He felt hope. The power went on at noon on September 5th, as Brad had promised. The air raid siren atop of the county courthouse went on with a huge braying whoop, scaring many people into the streets, where they looked wildly up into the blameless blue sky for a glimpse of the dark man's air force. Some ran for their cellars, where they stayed until Brad found a fused switch and turned the siren off. Then they came up, shamefaced. There was an electrical fire on Willow Street, and a group of a dozen volunteer fire people promptly rushed over and put it out. A manhole cover exploded into the air at the Broadway and Walnut intersection, went nearly 50 feet, and came down on the roof of the Oz toy shop like a great rusty tiddlywink. There was a single fatality on what the zone came to call Power Day. For some unknown reason, an auto body shop on Outer Pearl Street exploded. Rich Moffat was sitting in a doorway across the street with a bottle of Jack Daniels in his newsboy's pouch, and a flying panel of corrugated steel siding struck him and killed him instantly. He would break no more plate glass windows. Stu was with Fran when the fluorescence buzzed into life in the ceiling of her hospital room. He watched them flicker, 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 and finally catch with the old familiar light. He was unable to look away until they had been glowing solidly for nearly 3 minutes. When he looked at Franny again, her eyes were shiny with tears. "Fran, what's wrong? Is it the pain?" "It's Nick," she said. "It's so wrong that Nick isn't alive to see this. Hold me, Stu. I want to pray for him if I can. I want to try." He held her, but didn't know if she prayed or not. He suddenly found himself missing Nick very much, and hating Harold Lauder more than he ever had before. Fran was right. Harold had not just killed Nick and Sue. He had stolen their light. "Shh," he said. "Franny, shh." But she cried for a long time. When the tears were finally gone, he used the button to raise her bed and turned on the night table lamp so she could see to read. Stu was being shaken awake, and it took him a long time to come all the way around. His mind ran over a slow and seemingly endless list of people who might be trying to rob his sleep. It was his mother, telling him it was time to get up and light the stoves and get ready for school. It was Manuel, the bouncer in that sleazy little Nueva Luerdo whorehouse, telling him his $20 was used up and it would be another 20 if he wanted to stay all night. It was a nurse in a white all-over suit who wanted to take his blood pressure and a throat culture. It was Franny. It was Randall Flagg. The last thought brought him up like a dash of cold water in the face. It was none of these people. It was Glenn Bateman with Kojak at his knee.
"You're a hard man to wake up, East Texas," Glenn said, "like a stone post."
He was only a vague shape in nearly total darkness.
"Well, you could have turned on the damn light to start with."
"You know, I clean forgot all about that." Stu switched on the lamp, squinted against the sudden bright light, and peered owlishly at the wind-up alarm clock. It was 3:15 in the morning.
"What are you doing here, Glenn? I was sleeping in case you didn't happen to notice."
He got his first good look at Glenn as he put the clock down. He looked pale, scared, and old. The lines were drawn deeply into his face, and he looked haggard.
"What is it?"
"Mother Abigail," Glenn said quietly.
"Dead?
God help me, I almost wish she were. She's awake. She wants us."
"The two of us?"
"The five of us. She..." His voice roughened, went hoarse.
"She knew Nick and Susan were dead, and she knew Fran was in the hospital. I don't know how, but she did."
"And she wants the committee?"
"What's left of it.
She's dying, and she says she has to tell us something. And I don't know if I want to hear it."
Outside, the night was cold. Not just chilly, but cold.
The jacket Stu had pulled from the closet felt good, and he zipped it all the way to the neck. A frosty moon hung overhead, making him think of Tom, who had instructions to come back to them and report when the moon was full. This moon was just a trifle past the first quarter. God knew where that moon was looking down on Tom, on Dana Jurgens, on Judge Ferris. God knew it was looking down on strange doings here.
"I got Ralph up first," Glenn said. "Told him to go over to the hospital and get Fran."
"If the doctor wanted her up and around, he would have sent her home," Stu said angrily.
"This is a special case, Stu."
"For someone who doesn't want to hear what that old woman has to say, you seem to be in an all-fired hurry to get to her."
"I'm afraid not to," Glenn said.
The Jeep drew up in front of Larry's house at 3:10. The place was blazing with light. Not gas lamps now, but good electric lights. Every second street lamp was on, too, not just here, but all over town. And Stu had stared at them all the way over in Glenn's Jeep, fascinated. The last of the summer bugs, sluggish with the cold, were beating lackadaisically against the sodium globes. They got out of the Jeep just as headlights swung around the corner. It was Ralph's clattering old truck, and it pulled up nose to nose with the Jeep. Ralph got out, and Stu went quickly around to the passenger side, where Franny sat with her back resting against a plaid sofa cushion.
"Hey, babe," he said softly.
She took his hand. Her face was a pale disk in the darkness.
"Bad pain?" Stu asked.
"Not so bad. I took some Advil. Just don't ask me to do the hustle." He helped her out of the truck, and Ralph took her other arm. They both saw her wince as she stepped away from the cab.
"Want me to carry you?"
"I'll be fine. Just keep your arm around me, huh?"
"Sure will."
"And walk slow. Us Grammys can't go very fast." They crossed behind Ralph's truck, more shuffling than walking. When they reached the sidewalk, Stu saw Glenn and Larry standing in the doorway, watching them. Against the light, they looked like figures cut from black construction paper.
"What is it, do you think?" Franny murmured.
Stu shook his head.
"I don't know."
They got up the walk, Franny very obviously in pain now, and Ralph helped Stu get her in. Larry, like Glenn, looked pale and worried. He was wearing faded jeans, a shirt that was untucked and buttoned wrong at the bottom, and expensive mocks on bare feet.
"I'm sorry like hell to have to get you out," he said.
"I was in with her, dozing off and on. We've been keeping watch, you understand?"
"Yes, I understand," Franny said.
For some reason, the phrase keeping watch made her think of her mother's parlor, and in a kinder, more forgiving light than she had ever thought of it before. Lucy had been in bed about an hour.
I snapped out of my doze and... Fran, can I help you? Fran shook her head and smiled with an effort. No, I'm fine. Go on. And she was looking at me. She can't talk above a whisper, but she's perfectly understandable. Larry swallowed. All five of them were now standing in the hallway. She told me the Lord was going to take her home at the sunrise, but that she had to talk to those of us God hadn't taken first. I asked her what she meant, and she said God had taken Nick and Susan. She knew. He let out a ragged breath and ran his hands through his long hair. Lucy appeared at the end of the hall. I made coffee. It's here when you want it. Thank you, love, Larry said. Lucy looked uncertain. Should I come in with you folks, or is it private like the committee? Larry looked at Stu, who said quietly, Come on along. I got an idea that stuff don't cut ice anymore. They went up the hall to the bedroom, moving slowly to accommodate Fran. She'll tell us, Ralph said suddenly. Mother will tell us. No sense fretting. They went in together, and Mother Abigail's bright, dying gaze fell upon them. Fran knew about the old woman's physical condition, but it was still a nasty shock. There was nothing left of her but a pemmican-tough membrane of skin and tendon binding her bones. There was not even a smell of putrescence and oncoming death in the room. Instead, there was a dry attic smell. No, a parlor smell. Half the length of the IV needle hung out of her flesh simply because there was nowhere for it to go. Yet the eyes had not changed. They were warm and kind and human. That was a relief, but Fran still felt a kind of terror, not strictly fear, but perhaps something more sanctified. Awe. Was it awe? An impending feeling, not doom, but as though some dreadful responsibility was poised above their heads like a stone. Man proposes, God disposes.
Little girl, sit down, Mother Abigail whispered. You're in pain.
Larry led her to an armchair, and Fran sat down with a thin, whistling sigh of relief, although she knew even sitting would pain her after a while. Mother Abigail was still watching her with those bright eyes.
You're quick with child, she whispered.
Yes, how—
Shh!
Silence fell in the room, deep silence. Fascinated, hypnotized, Fran looked at the dying old woman who had been in their dreams before she had been in their lives.
Look out the window, little girl.
Fran turned her face to the window where Larry had stood and looked out at the gathered people 2 days before. She saw not pressing darkness, but a quiet light. It was not a reflection of the room. It was morning light. She was looking at the faint, slightly distorted reflection of a bright nursery with ruffled check curtains. There was a crib, but it was empty. There was a playpen, empty. A mobile of bright plastic butterflies, moved only by the wind. Dread clapped its cold hands around her heart. The others saw it on her face, but did not understand it. They saw nothing through the window but a section of lawn lit by a streetlight.
Where's the baby? Fran asked hoarsely. Stuart is not the baby's father, little girl. But his life is in Stuart's hands and in God's. This chap will have four fathers, if God lets him draw breath at all.
If he draws,
God has hidden that from my eyes, she whispered.
The empty nursery was gone. Fran saw only darkness, and now dread closed its hands into fists, her heart beating between them. Mother Abigail whispered,
The imp has called his bride, and he means to put her with child. Will he let your child live?
Stop it, Franny moaned. She put her hands over her face. Silence, deep silence, like snow in the room. Glenn Bateman's face was an old dull searchlight. Lucy's right hand worked slowly up and down the neck of her bathrobe. Ralph had his hat in his hands, picking absently at the feather in the band. Stu looked at Franny, but could not go to her. Not now. He thought fleetingly of the woman at the meeting,
the one who had put her hands rapidly over her eyes, ears, and mouth at the mention of the dark man's name.
"Mother, father, wife, husband," Mother Abigail whispered. "Set against them?